And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Let's do this thing indeed. Back in studio.
Number 18?
I can't count that high. Is that what
18.
We're at? 18.
18? 18.
And they said it would never
Shocker.
Last.
Shocker.
Welcome.
I didn't think we'd get to one.
To think we can vote.
Yes. Welcome to Chatter on Books.
At Chatter.
Yes.
Corner of Wisconsin, Jennifer Streets, Northwest.
5247 Wisconsin Avenue, Northwest, and at a for-profit business. All kinds of great stuff.
Yes.
If you want to watch baseball, they got 11 TVs here to watch baseball. You want to host a party, you can do that. You want to buy a gift card for somebody, you can do all that.
You want to see the Final Four?
You want to see the Final Four, this is the place to see. Right. You want to watch the Masters in a couple of weeks, this is the place to do it. So
curling?
Yes.
Can we watch curling here?
You damn straight
in a while.
You can.
Yeah.
Damn straight
curling.
You can.
Curling. Jeannie McManus is here. Michael Kornheiser is here. Mark Stern is here. I'm Tori Clark. David Aldridge is in New York?
He's on assignment in New York, yes.
For us, for Chatter on Books?
Sure.
Is he finding really good authors?
Yes. Sure.
All right, we've got wonderful things on tap for this evening. We have an announcement about Battle of the Books. I'm very excited. It's on the website. We have Books That Should Be Movies, a segment that Jeannie and I have talked about for a while, which now that you're back, we can do that. We have Kyle Swenson, who's from the Washington Post, and has a really, really remarkable book called Good Kids, Bad City, A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. It's remarkable.
You don't want to live in Cleveland.
You don't
want
to live in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Not
I mean, with all due respect to
Are you saying
other
that?
People
is
in
Sam
Cleveland.
Weiss, is Sam Weiss saying that?
Yeah, Sam Weiss.
Which famous? Did you do Marvin Gaye on Tony's show today?
We did not. This is a tough day for Marvin Gaye.
Yeah.
This was
the
day.
It was his last day.
This was the day he passed. Tomorrow would have been his birthday. So we did not. We played Laugh Laugh by the Bo Brummels.
Fans of the Tony Kornheiser Show and this one will know the cobbler, as I call him, over off Connecticut Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, you probably went to Raymer's next door to get shoes when you were a child, right? And right next to it is the cobbler, which is spectacular. And they often have little trivia questions up on the board. And if you guess the trivia question correctly, you get 15% off your repair. And normally I never guess them, but today it was famous musician died today, April 1, and I guessed it. It's Marvin Gaye. So if anybody's in a shoe repair, let me know. I'll take them in with me next time. And so, but in honor of April Fool's Day, instead of deserted island recommendations, we're going to do recommended books about great cons or great books about cons. Thank you again to Claire, who was doing a great job on Facebook. Thank
She's
you very,
the best.
Very much.
Claire
and she makes a great shortbread cookie.
Yes, she does.
Yeah, she does.
Multi-talented,
yeah.
Claire. Multi-talented. By popular demand, David's book report is now, I think my social media director, also known as Devin Graham, has put it out on Twitter. But I got several requests for David's book report, so it is out. It's on Twitter. If you follow us on DC Books Chatter, you too can read David's book report.
How about that? And we discussed this off air. I know David and I did. I'm sure he talked to you guys about this, whether he should assign his next task for you, like, while he was away. And I said, no, we want to have the whole
Let's
full
stretch
enjoyment
out
of that.
The pain. Yeah.
He's,
he's
got to look you in the eye when he assigns that book.
Seriously, whenever I think about it, I start this, like, rocking, going, oh, it just brings back all these bad memories of school. Thank you to everybody for the recommendations about authors. And the good news is, coming up, if you go to chatteronbooks.com, Julie Langsdorf, who wrote the book The White Elephant, only one from that New York Times list, we've got her signed up. We have Abby Maslin. I think, Mark, you and Michael were both talking about her. Again, local woman. She and her husband went through a terrible thing. The book is called Love You Hard, and her husband was beaten up coming out of a Nats game.
That was a terrible story.
There's an update in the Washington Post, I believe, from a week ago, if you want to catch up on her story.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty remarkable. As Mark and I were saying, it could be a tough show, but a really, really important
piece of work. I really look forward to having her in studio. It's one of those stories that, I mean, it breaks your heart, but it captures your imagination. I mean, it's because they've updated it through the years, so I feel like I've been sort of following along.
And remarkable for them to give so much of themselves for that. So that's good. And then Sean Doolittle. Several people said to us, reach out to Sean Doolittle, Nats pitcher, big fan of reading, loves books, talks about books as they're part of how he relaxes and how he alleviates the pressure that goes along with playing in the major leagues. And so we have a good line in with Sean Doolittle and hope to have him soon.
We'll see how much it relieves the pressure
when he's here. And Mark,
he read at the Cleveland Park Library last summer, and Walker got to meet him.
How about that?
Do you have pictures?
We do.
We don't put out pictures of Master Walker.
Not of the little kid.
Are you already teaching Walker to shake with his left hand so we can get him throwing lefty?
Well, I have the right strap to his side, so there's only one option to be polite.
That's perfect.
And Mark, can we announce your news?
Yes, we can.
Go. Oh,
very exciting. I have signed a contract, a deal with a publisher.
Did you have anyone other than yourself look at this contract?
I did, yes, okay. I did. I had a couple of attorneys
Reginald?
Look at it. Reginald looked at it, threw some feces at it, and I, you know, marked it up
That's
with some
sign.
Notes. No, I'm very excited. Post Hill Press has decided to sign me on for a second book in what I hope is going to be a series of books about animals in history committing
Yay!
Acts of bravery. The first one was obviously Simon the Sea Cat. This next book is going to be a book about a dog on the Titanic.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Well, true story, right?
Well...
Perhaps apocryphal.
Legend has it. I choose to believe it. There's a lot of people who are like, absolutely did not happen, but there is a lot of evidence out there. In fact, I saw some articles written in the New York Examiner back in 1912, like right after everything happened, and they made reference to this incident and this dog. So it's definitely out there in the lore of the Titanic. Some people might say it never happened, but, you know, it's whatever truth you choose.
I can't get enough about the Titanic.
I know.
I got to tell you. That is one that I could just go on forever.
The last survivor died not too long ago, right? Didn't
you're
see
right.
that somewhere?
Right? Yeah. So, and I love the research for that particular, you know, incident. So
Walter Lord, A Night to Remember.
Yes.
Perfect.
That's
yes,
a great book.
Yes. So I'm hopefully going to have that out. So I think my deadline, I've never had a deadline before, but it's in October, so I'm already starting to sweat that.
Welcome to the adult world.
You've never had a deadline. What is that like?
Yeah. But I'm also looking for illustrators, so if you would like to be an illustrator, not that I don't love my other illustrator, Miriam.
I've seen Baby Walker produce some pretty interesting things with a Crayola.
I'm talking to him. He's got some pretty tough representatives.
He's an abstract thinker.
Yeah. But you can reach us at jingles@tonykornheiser.com.
Excellent.
Is where I'm sort of aggregating all of them. So.
Congratulations.
Thank you
very
much.
That's
very,
very exciting.
I'm very excited.
I keep thinking about partnerships with Humane Society and entities like that.
Oh, I'm working.
That's fabulous.
No, that is a step I'm working on. I actually have a big fish I'm trying to attract
to write a story about.
No. So it's a celebrity that I want to get involved because they're a big advocate for animals. So I want to pick a charity that they're supportive of.
Oh, so by a big fish, you don't mean literally a fish?
No, it's not a fish.
Okay, I thought maybe you were trying to attract like.
No,
I did too.
No,
I went right to that.
A bass.
No, there is a guy that I'm a big fan of, and he's a really big star.
Okay.
So I'm hopeful. To get him.
Leonardo. Thank
really?
You. Yeah.
Can you get him on the show?
I ain't gonna ask.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Good.
We'd be happy
know who it
to
is?
Have Leonardo.
Do you know? Want to know who it is before I tell you? Before we book him.
Sure.
Ricky Gervais?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
You guys would be okay with
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Yeah, right.
I mean, he's never
going to
say yes, but I got to ask him.
You never know. And if you can, I would not say set your sights lower, but up the road from us a mile or two lives John Carlson of the Washington Caps, he and his wife are both big
on
animals and humane issues.
You know what? I need to cast a wide net. I've got a few people on my list, so.
At the very least, we could do some improvisational comedy with him.
Yeah, Mason, thank you.
Okay, and now I'm going to our cheese and wine
YouTube
of the wine and cheese of the evening. I have to tell you guys, I love coming here to do the show on Monday evenings. I now love going to Calvert Woodley on Monday afternoons and seeing the scene at Calvert Woodley at 4339 Connecticut Avenue. La Cheeserie is amazing. They're always delightful to talk to. Again, the wine selection, I don't know a lot. My husband Brian out there does. But the wine selection looks vast. The beer selection, about which I do know something, is pretty vast. The liquors are all there. The people are so kind. And the people that you see in there are dedicated shoppers. Very, very dedicated shoppers. But it's always nice to stop by. And today, Jeannie is going to help me with her comments about this. It is a 2018 Sancerre. It is a rosé, which we had not seen before.
Never had it.
I have not talked to Michael Sands today, whom is just the most wonderful guy. But I'm thinking maybe it was in honor of the cherry blossoms. I'm going to make that up. But maybe it's on the cherry blossoms. But this is from, let me get the name correct. It is from Jean-Marc and, I can't even pronounce the other name, Crochet Vineyard. And it is absolutely lovely. It is a family-owned, of course it's family-owned, five generations family-owned vineyard. And they talk about how they do this not in the oak because that would convey some taste that you wouldn't want, but they're on these thermo something or other barrels. They make very little of this every year. It is they make approximately 4,000 bottles a year.
Wow.
Thermo-regulated, I'm sorry, it's thermo-regulated stainless steel tanks. Bottle conditioned and stored on the property. Michael, you probably know something about this. They made a big deal when I was reading about this. They hand prune these vineyards. No machines involved, so it's all done by hand.
You can taste the difference.
Excellent. Speaking of tasting notes, so Jeannie, what do you detect?
I like Sancerre. Mm-hmm. I don't always like a rosé. Sometimes rosés can be too sweet for mm-hmm. me. But this, it's less citrusy than a white Sancerre. It's very mellow, but without being sweet.
There you go.
That's as sort of winey as I can possibly sound.
They talk a little minerally on the finish.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go. This says it's soft on the attack, full-bodied on the palate. Appetizing notes of citrus and grapefruit zest confirm a crisp, round acidity that flows into a long finish.
But not too citrusy, which is what I like about it.
No, absolutely lovely. So we got that. And then we have our cheese, which Jeannie immediately recognized as a Morbier. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Well, I recognized what that line was, which is ash.
So it's a cow cheese. Yeah. It's semi-soft. And I learned that this one is made, traditionally has been made, where they take the second milking of the day, the end of the day, and they had some leftover milk, throw it in the pans or whatever it is, and then cover it with this vegetable ash. And then the next day they put the morning milk on top of it, and that's why it has this distinctive line running through the middle. But
well,
it's lovely.
That?
It is absolutely mm-hmm. lovely. And La Cheeserie guys were raving about it. One of their favorites, goes with a lot of things. They use a word with which I don't agree, leathery. I don't think it's leathery at all.
No, it's very creamy and mellow, I think.
So it's lovely. But thank you, Calvert Woodley.
Yeah. Yes,
thank you, Calvert Woodley.
A kid-friendly cheese, I'd say.
Yes. Yeah, it can't be too strong, right? Couldn't do a blue cheese with Master Walker?
Ooh, I don't know if that would settle well on his little stomach.
you got to hook him on that stuff early, I think, though.
All right, before we get to...
is this about books, this
movies?
Show?
Yeah, I'm thirsty and hungry now.
As we always say, ostensibly about books, but about a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But now it is about Battle of the Books.
And
But it's up on the website. Okay. If you go to chatteronbooks.com, you too can read information about the Battle of the Books, which we like to say is a cross between The Voice and the Nobel Prize for Literature, just a little bit.
I was hoping to see a line of struggling artists outside the restaurant this afternoon.
They will be soon. Even though we had not put this up yet, I've gotten people who are sending me random emails going, you know, my six-year-old has written a really great book. Can they come by? But this really is for people to come to us with their unpublished books. But finished. Yeah, not a chapter. Book must
be
finished. Right,
got to be finished.
You're out, Mark. Sorry.
That's okay.
You're out. You're
That's
published,
okay.
right?
Yeah, I'm a published author, yes.
There you go.
Yes.
So everybody, except those who have already been published, first Monday of each month, is what we've picked. So they'll be here. We're going to have three contestants per show. Each one has 2 minutes to pitch us on their book.
This is like Shark Tank, right?
It's like It is like the Shark Tank. It's like Voice. It's put all these things together.
I love it. They pitch it to us.
Yeah. We get to ask questions. You get to be Simon.
Yeah, I get to be Simon Cowell, right?
Absolutely.
That's all I care about.
Can I be J-Lo? That would take some work.
Sounds a little pitchy
to me. I'm not
going to
be Paula.
But they got to do their elevator pitch, and then we'll decide among ourselves, and we'll pick one winner. There will be fabulous prizes for everybody. But an individual winner gets a $50 Chatter gift card, of course.
Great.
And the opportunity to come back at the end of the season, haven't decided yet what the season is, and compete in the finals, for which there will be a $1,000 prize.
Wow.
And you say, I can't be part of this?
You cannot be part of this. Yeah. You could pay off some of those illustrators if you could win this thing. Dan Pink, I'm going to call him out on this one, has already offered to be a judge for the finals. He wants to be a judge for the finals.
Yeah, he'd be
right?
great.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
go to the website. They're right on the main tab there. It says Battle of the Books. You can get a little bit more information. Here's how you register. You just got to give some basic information and 100 words or less on what your book is about. And then we'll follow up and get you in.
And the entry fee is just $500 each,
just
right?
$500. Man, that's a Tori Clark. That's T-O-R.
That is awesome. I can't
Isn't
wait
great?
For that.
I think it'd be fun.
I like this.
I think it'd be really
fun. Yeah.
I've had people stop me when I'm out walking the dogs, which means I need to start going out earlier in the morning.
With your baseball cap pulled down further.
Oh, you have a show? Where's that show? Is it at Bowie Mongers? Where are you doing that show? So I think we'll get some people.
Oh, we
good.
Definitely will.
Yeah.
We definitely will.
All right, books that should be movies. This is one Jeannie and I have talked about for a long time. I've got about 18 of these. Who would like to go first?
Well, would you, since you have 18? Do you want to lead off?
Yeah, I'll go first.
Okay.
It is John Meacham. I would read The Phone Book if John Meacham wrote it, because he does things so well. But he wrote a book which I don't think too many people paid attention to, which is called Franklin and Winston. And it's just a lovely book, and it is a love story of these two guys. And it always reminds me of that line from Hamilton, which I'm sure I'll get wrong, but what are the odds the gods would put us together at this time? it's you just go, wow, it was really remarkable that these two guys
yes.
were in those roles at that time.
Yeah, that particular time in history that yeah. those two guys yeah. were alive and in the position to sort of be doing what
they
were
they
doing. And the meeting yeah. of the minds and souls. Really.
Yeah. And I can't think of anybody other than Gary Oldman who would play Winston Churchill because he's kind of got the part taken.
Yeah.
Then, interestingly, I saw where Kyle MacLachlan
of oh, sure.
Twin Peaks fame
yeah.
signed up to do some Norwegian production about Franklin Roosevelt. I can only imagine. Franklin Roosevelt and Kippers. but I could see him as doing it. I could see him as doing it. So those are my two people for my movie.
Oh, so we're casting.
Oh, I didn't
well.
Realize I had to cast.
You want to.
All
right. I did. You don't have
so
to.
So the one book that I would love to see as a movie is All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
Oh, yeah.
This is a book that takes place during World War II. There's a young girl in France. There's a young boy in Germany. The young girl, so it's kind of a war story. In a way, it's kind of a love story between these two very young people, but it's also kind of a mystery. The girl lives in France. Her father's a caretaker for a museum that holds a very precious stone. There are copies of this precious stone, and only one person has the real stone, and other people have the copies. The Nazis are coming to Paris. They flee. Meanwhile, and this is the great thing about this book, the voice goes back and forth from the young girl in France to the young boy in Germany. The young boy in Germany, who's kind of a naif and gets conscripted into the German army and has to do certain things that he has to do. And you are on the edge of your seat the whole time yeah. with this book. And I can just see in the right hands with the sort of right aura about this world. This could just yeah. be, and you'd need two very young, talented, unknown
yeah, they'd
actors.
Have to be unknown.
Yeah.
Sean Connery, maybe?
No.
That sounds brilliant.
No. Kevin Costner.
Yeah, sure.
No,
yeah.
for the kids, it's crucial yeah. that they be unknowns, and I'm sure you could find them.
It's funny that as soon as you said the title, I went, oh, love that. And that book was so well done, I see it. You
yes,
know, I think visually,
I did too.
But I almost go, oh, wait a minute, didn't I see that movie? Because it hasn't been made yet.
Remember, the little girl becomes blind, and so the father, who's very good with his woodworking skills, builds a replica of
That's
the
right.
city so that she can feel her way, as blind as she is, through the streets and navigate yeah. with her hands this wood reconstruction. So when it comes time for her to have to navigate, she knows where this
yeah.
street is and this building is. And
wow.
That, yeah.
I know why mine would not be made, the world doesn't need another movie about two old white guys, right? And that's why that probably hasn't been done. I'm amazed that one hasn't been done.
Apparently it was optioned and then something fell through.
Yeah,
and then it was
I can think
again,
it always does.
And something fell through. I mean, it would not be a cheap movie to produce,
right.
obviously.
Right. But a good one.
Yeah.
And this is why this question is so tough, because all of these books that get billed as these top fiction, modern, or sort of literary works are optioned. I mean, you think about the story of A Confederacy of Dunces, which was optioned
right.
and has gone through so many different rewrites, and you're just not sure if it'll ever come out because it's been known as that book that can't be turned into a script successfully. So because it's been so difficult, I went back to fantasy, and this is a fantasy series. The first one's called A Darker Shade of Magic, V.E. Schwab. And you could argue that this is in the YA genre. It's very accessible. It is a look at a world where magic is alive and well, and it focuses on London. Now, there are three distinct Londons. There's a red London where, I want to make sure I get this right, there is a red London where life and magic are revered, magic is alive, there's a monarchy that is alive, strong, doing well. Their son, Rai Marish, is heir, and he's a little bit, I would say, a little bit distant from his responsibilities because he's been in this protected, safe, successful, rich world. And we have Grey London, which is actually the London that we would recognize. It has Mad King George. It's a London where magic no longer exists and where everyone has forgotten that it once did exist. And then we also have a believe it's a white London. I haven't read in a while, but where there are warring parties, there are brothers, where people are fighting over any scraps of magic, where there is dangerous magic that is alive. And a character enters, a traveler, who is the ambassador in Red London, who's able to travel between these Londons as an ambassador. And what's really interesting is he is the sort of adopted brother of Rye Marish, the heir to the throne, but he doesn't know his own backstory. And because of this, he is, I would say, separate from the royal family in a way, different from his adopted brother. His adopted brother just never has had to really pay attention to his obligation. It's always been there. We begin to find out that he's been spurned by a lover, and that's going to play a big part in later books. But for Kel, the ambassador, he feels the weight of being one of the last with this ability, but he also feels the curiosity of trying to figure out who he is, who is his family, what's his place in this world. So he becomes a smuggler, and he smuggles artifacts because there's always going to be that black market, that underground market between these Londons for different artifacts. And of course, there is a piece of magic that enters the story, a dangerous piece that he ends up losing. There's a pickpocket, someone who has ambition, someone who has vision for this magic, but is not from the magical world.
My God.
So it's what I really like is it's a vivid portrayal of a world that we know,
sure.
But it's not really tied to any London that we recognize. The river is still very key. That's where the magic is stored. But it doesn't necessarily take us down the river where we see Tower Bridge, where we see St. Paul's Cathedral.
So do you see this as animated, this movie, or some combination of both?
So it could be an interesting live animated movie, because I do think the structural piece of trying to create, you know, sort of this blasted world without magic, that you still can see some of the effects of it there. So that'd be an interesting take. One of the things I like is the characters, these two young men, they are given distinct personalities, but there's a lot of room for a skilled screenwriter to take them and run. Mm-hmm. They both have interesting backstories as to why they are the way they are, but it's not so scripted that you're stuck into, say, one character. And I think it gives you some room to be very creative in your casting to create this bond where they are brothers, but they don't necessarily look alike. They don't necessarily have the same sense of the world. And I think in a larger question, it has us all look at the idea of power and privilege. Why is it that this one London that has magic and is alive and well knows of and allows these other Londons to live without?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to see power shift throughout this, and it makes us all question our own responsibility. What do we have to do within our own city to make sure, say, my pocket of D.C. doesn't look one way while, say, another on the other side of the river looks a different way?
May I just repeat a public service announcement I made a few weeks ago? When it's time for me to do my book report, I'm just photoshopping my head on Michael's body, and he will do my book report. That's incredible.
That sounds good. What's the name of the book again?
So this is A Darker Shade of Magic. They're already out with all three in the trilogy,
and
the world does expand, but these characters are going to stay pretty true throughout. But it's fun, and I think what's great is it's approachable. So it could be something that you read with, say, a relative, say, a good friend, and it doesn't feel like it's one of those literary books that hits you over the head.
All right, fabulous. So the right studio, if you're listening, you've got like 10 movies out of this.
And yeah, I can think of 18 different directors who'd be fabulous doing
me
that.
Yeah, too.
Okay, Mark?
I'm going to go back.
Simon the Sea Cat.
Okay, well, Simon the Sea Cat obviously would be the best movie.
Pumping Irony.
The Pumping Irony as well. I'm going to go back to World War II, where you guys have been fishing.
Pretty amazing, the obsession with World War II.
Yeah.
Well, Nazi Germany in particular.
Yeah.
There are so many great stories that come out of that. And obviously a million have been
what
written.
What was the guy's name? You were talking about this a few weeks ago. The guy who volunteered to go into the camp?
Oh, we told Pilecki, I think. I think that was his name, the Polish officer.
The incredible movie, but go ahead.
Yeah, that one is always my standby. Like, I want to write the screenplay for that. But since I've already discussed that, I want to talk about another true story. The only thing that's bad about this is the operation's name. The code name for the spy was named Nimrod. That's the only, and it's terrible. But this guy is a guy named Stephen Rigby. He was born in Frankfurt, and then he became a British citizen before World War I. And he ended up being a spy and serving in something called the X Troops for Lord Mountbatten, who apparently, like, people didn't even know they existed. It was like the secret guys. And he was tasked with pretending to be a triple agent over in France to convince the Germans that the invasion was not going to happen in Normandy, that it was going to happen in Calais. which was, you know, there was always a big argument. Is it going to be Calais? Is it going to be in Normandy? And so he went over to France. He spent years sort of perfecting this character, all these different identities, basically to the point where he didn't know who he was. And he got over there, and I'm trying to get this right. So he made sure he got caught by the Germans in France. And he was disguised as a German field agent posing as a French resistance fighter. But when he got caught, he wanted to convince them that he was neither English nor French, but a German posing as both. So he was like deep, like triple undercover. And they beat the crap out of this guy in interrogation. And he finally gave it up that the invasion was going to be at Calais, when in fact it was going to be at Normandy.
Wow. So, yeah, that's great.
And this from the Boston Globe. This is a book. The book is called The Unknown Soldier, The Allies' Greatest Deception in the Days Before D-Day by James Lesor. And this is what the Boston Globe wrote about it, which fits in perfectly. This is the stuff of which movies starring Burt Lancaster used
there
to
you
be
go.
Made.
Yep.
A hair raiser and eminently readable. So it's just, and again, it's 100% true. This is a guy that we've never heard of who altered the course of the war in the favor of the Allies and, you know, saved a lot of people.
Not to bring it down at all, because that sounds fabulous. What was the movie a few years ago, Brad Pitt, and he didn't know if his wife was...
Oh, Allied.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that with Angelina. Is Angelina Jolie in that? I don't know.
Yes.
No. It's,
charades, sounds like.
Darn it.
Three words. But you really didn't, through the movie, I went back and forth going, is she, isn't she? But the same kind of turmoil he went through. That's fabulous. Okay, we're going to break soon and come back with our author, but the
Marion
whole thing.
Marion Cotillard.
There you go. She was fabulous.
Yeah. She's brilliant.
This whole thing where the military names things. Right. People in the military would tell you, oh, it's computer generated.
Codename Nimrod is terrible.
Codename Nimrod. Although we had a lovely horse named Nimrod. But it's such hogwash. Pre-9/11, do you know what the most pressing issue on my table with the Pentagon was?
What?
Operation Amber Fox. Do you know what Operation Amber Fox was?
No.
No, you wouldn't know.
Is it about a woman?
Wait for that. Operation Amber Fox at the time was the Balkans. Pre-9/11, in terms of real military conflict, what people were thinking about was the Balkans. And it was a weapons collection program that they had named Operation Amber Fox. And it wasn't going very well. And so we're going through this for a few weeks, and there's a briefing in my office that morning, early morning of 9/11, and we're going to brief later in the day on Operation Amber Fox and why it wasn't going well. And the whole time that guys have been talking to me, and they're all guys, and telling me about this program, and no, people don't understand, and the media don't understand, there was just something in the back of my head going, Operation Amber Fox, Amber Fox, Amber Fox, right? Finally, prior to this meeting, I Google it, and I go, Amber Fox. It's a porn star.
It was
a porn star.
Of course.
And so
is that with three X's? Fox?
Probably was. And so that morning, this was a couple hours before 9/11 unfolded, I'm sitting around this table with a bunch of people with a bunch of shiny stuff on their shoulders, and I said, I am not the military expert in the room, but perhaps if we called it something like Operation Weapons Collection, they might actually turn in their weapons collection. But it was Amber Fox. There you go. Okay. All these books should be movies.
Yeah.
So we are now going to
And we're happy to help with the,
exactly.
Yeah, for a
consultants.
Small fee.
Consultants.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't work Thursday through Sunday.
And I'm now working on a screenplay for Amber Fox.
Be easily done. Calling Stormy. Okay, we're going to take a break. Come back with Kyle Swenson.
Yes.
Excellent.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. For you, it was just a moment. For us, 16 hours.
Time to refill.
Yeah, we have refill glasses.
With our wonderful wine from Calvert Woodley this evening, which is a Sancerre Rosé, which Jeannie and I didn't even know existed. But it's lovely.
Now
really
you
lovely. Thank you, Michael.
Fans. Yes,
really
thank,
big fans.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you, everyone from Calvert Woodley.
Yeah. And Kyle Swenson, thank you for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Washington Post guy, author of this, I just keep using the word remarkable, but it's a remarkable book. Good
thank
Kids,
you.
Bad City, and the subhead is A Story of Race and Wrongful Conviction in America. And true story, as I've been putting notes together and writing outlines and things like that over the last several days, the autocorrect kept putting in rage and wrongful conviction in America. And not to be too maudlin about this, but the more I read, and I told you earlier today, I listened to it as well, the angrier I got.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I actually sat down to write the book because I was so angry about the situation.
Yeah.
Because I felt that nobody kind of was paying attention or had kind of absorbed what this story was saying about the criminal justice system in America and our society.
So one of the things you said early on, I want to come back to that because I also got angry about the way at the end, that, and essentially the story is about three guys who spent the longest wrongful incarceration yet so far, right?
Combined, 106 years.
On the basis of a 12-year-old boy who was lying and making up stories and being convinced to say things he didn't really believe.
Paid to say things.
For $50.
Yeah.
And when the big-time media came in at the end, when they're about to have these convictions overturned, you got angry, as did I, about how they oversimplified it, which they really did, because it's about so many things. But I want, we usually, with these sessions, we like to hear a little bit about your backstory, what it was like as a kid. But I was so struck, and I like to mention the name of the book a lot, Good Kids, Bad City, but I was so struck, and it took about halfway through the book, but in here, and you're from Cleveland, and in here you say, I finally also realized my initial inability to empathize with these guys was exactly because of my background. I had been suspicious that the justice system could jail the wrong men because I had never been on the wrong end of the justice system. No one I was close to had ever even been arrested. It was easy from my perspective to let those jailhouse letters pile up in a desk drawer. Mm. So what got you angry and what got you convinced to pursue this story?
Well, that's kind of like the moral climax of the story, I think, from my point of view. And what got me angry was that when these guys finally got out of prison in 2014, it was kind of this big media dog and pony show. You know, CNN.
Everybody
was there. Because at the time, specifically Ricky Jackson, who's one of the three men I write about, he had been in prison for 39 years, which is the longest wrongful conviction, a sole sentence. It's since we've beaten that record, unfortunately, which I think says a lot about the country. But so he got out after 39 years. It was a very big media event. And I just realized that they were asking, it just seemed it was a celebratory tone, really. You know, it was like, oh, well, something bad happened decades ago, but, you know, we fixed it. He's out now.
He was a teenager when he went in.
18 years old. 18 years old. So this man's basically his entire life had been stolen by this situation. And, you know, they would ask the questions. I remember he takes a step. He was taking his first steps as a free man in the courthouse lobby. And they were saying, oh, well, you know, what's your first meal going to be? Or where are you going to go? And knowing Ricky very well since, you know, I know that his whole head was just a blur at that point. He had no, he wasn't thinking, the last thing he was thinking about was where he was going to go eat.
Yeah, there's no frame of reference.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to.
So I felt that the coverage was very shallow because we were asking, we were very oriented about what was happening next. Like, what will you do next? But we didn't ask the right questions about, you know, how the heck did this happen?
Yeah.
Why did this happen? Who was responsible? And so that got me actually very frustrated, and I realized that I wanted to do a book, and I wanted to name names. I wanted to say why this happened. I wanted to dissect this on every level possible.
And you did, and just Jeannie and I were talking before the show, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it was about, it was obviously it was about the criminal justice system, but it was about what was going on with subprime, the subprime housing disaster. It went through so many educational system in Cleveland at the time. We don't want to beat up on Cleveland, but a few weeks ago, as I was saying to you earlier, we had Kevin Sullivan and Mary Jordan on talking about the three women who were held. And a lot of that was people just turned a blind eye to what was going on around them. But what was going on in the Cleveland you were growing up in that allowed this to happen?
Well, it was interesting because the Cleveland I grew up in, of course, in like the 2000s, in the late 90s, I would say, was incredibly racially stratified. Race was always a big issue in Cleveland. Everyone always talked about race. It was always on the table. And I think that was actually very informative because I know a lot of cities kind of beat around the bush. They're afraid to talk about how, you know, certain neighborhoods don't get the same type of attention or economic development that other neighborhoods do.
Right.
Or that certain neighborhoods or certain people are treated differently by the police and prosecutors. So that was always on the table in Cleveland, but what was really fascinating to me was then to really dig into why it got that way, because these men were convicted in 1975, so it was a history lesson to figure out what Cleveland was like then, and it was incredibly racially stratified at the same time because of a lot of interesting developments. You know, Cleveland at this Cleveland had this famous moment in the 1960s and 1967 when Carl Stokes was elected the mayor of Cleveland, who's really a forgotten kind of hero of the civil rights movement because he was the first African-American man to become the mayor of a city. And his whole agenda was about cleaning up the police department because he knew from being a black man in Cleveland how the police treated black people. And so he launched a very progressive agenda on this front and got a lot of backlash. And that really kind of electrified the racial lines in Cleveland between the community, the black community, and the police department. So that was really the backstop of what happened with this case. That's the history that was feeding into it.
It almost started the whole thing.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so talk to me about Edward.
So Edward Vernon was a 12-year-old boy from the neighborhood. These guys all lived on the east side of Cleveland, predominantly African-American neighborhood. So Edward Vernon was younger than these three guys I write about. He was the paper boy. He had thick glasses. He didn't have many friends. He was kind of like the geeky, nerdy guy around the neighborhood. And on May 19th, 1975, there's a corner store robbery. A white man who's a money order salesman is leaving a store, and he gets robbed and gunned down. And Edward, in a couple days later, emerges as a witness and says that he saw these three guys who I write about commit this crime. Of course, it was all BS. He didn't see this. He was at school at the time.
He wanted to be helpful.
He was just trying to be helpful. So, you know, when I was initially reporting on this story in 2011, when I was working as a reporter in Cleveland, you know, I was digging into it, and I realized that Edward is kind of the linchpin here, that he was the one who made the case. He was the only...
He was the case.
Yes.
He was
it. Yeah. Although there were other possibilities for witnesses who were ignored.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was just all that they had, basically, the state had. And so in my mind, I really built up this animosity. I write in the book, I think, that he was the villain kind of in my mind because this little boy actually had done so much. And then when I finally talked to Edward, when I got to know him...
As a 40-plus-year-old man,
yes,
correct?
Whose own life had really been drastically altered by this case. Right. I mean, he fell into drug addiction for years. He eventually got clean. And when you go through the process of getting clean, you know, he knew what his triggers were. And his triggers were the guilt and the fear that he felt about this case.
Yeah.
So really, you know, I say now that this situation had four victims, that he was an initial victim. He was also a victim of this situation.
I have to tell you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but reading it and listening to it, I hated you. For making me feel sorry for him.
You're kinder than I would
be. Did that on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, nice.
Well, he had a, you know, and like I said, I kind of wanted the book to build him up as this villain like he was in my head, and then to kind of pull that out from under you, because really he was taken advantage of. He was pressured by the police to testify in these cases. He was told his parents would be arrested and charged with perjury if he didn't.
Which a 12-year-old would believe.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He told me one of the most moving things, and I write about this, is that he had told me when he was testifying in the cases, he was put in a Holiday Inn downtown.
Yeah.
His parents couldn't come see him. His friends couldn't come see him. The police paid for this Holiday Inn. And he just thought about throwing himself out the window and killing himself, which is, you know, for a 12-year-old boy to have that type of thought, I think really points towards the gravity that he was feeling in this situation. Mm-hmm.
If you had been able to get more information about the police at that time, which was hard almost 40 years later, could they have been the villains? Because I really wanted them to be.
Yeah, that was difficult. I mean, in my mind, you know, the title of the book gets to that. It's Good Kids, Bad City. And in my mind, the city is the police and the prosecutors and the system as manifested in the city. But the officers involved, which I found out in through reporting, you know, they had had other allegations of misconduct. There had been other allegations that they'd railroaded people, that they had beaten suspects, which happened in this case.
Shot people
left and right. It was a very violent time, and it kind of pointed to this larger picture of cynicism, I think, in American law enforcement and also in the law enforcement in Cleveland, that they didn't care necessarily that much about the neighborhoods that they were policing. It was more of an adversarial relationship.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit? I mean, again, I feel like you should either you have gone to law school or you qualified for having graduated from law school.
Well, you know, my mom and dad
school.
Keep telling me, you know, it's not too late to go to law
late.
School.
It's not.
Anything
really
but
not.
Journalism,
yeah,
please.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's literally what they've been saying.
But you learned a lot about the legal system. You learned a lot about, these are the wrong phrases, but almost the cottage industry of wrongful convictions and how that has grown up. I mean, you learned so much about the Innocence Project, which so many of these factors just playing together. But talk about the wrongful conviction cottage industry.
Well, our legal system as it sits right now, because of the way it's set up and also because of higher court decisions, it's just not set up to handle issues of innocence. If you say, I'm innocent, you know, after the judge slams that gavel and sentences you in your initial trial, the legal system doesn't care whether you still say you're innocent or not. And so what's been remarkable about the Innocence Project is, and throughout, is that they've had to work uphill basically against a system that doesn't really care whether or not you're guilty or innocent after your original trial, after the jury says guilty or innocent. So DNA has obviously been a huge linchpin, because DNA, you can say, look, no, the system was actually wrong. This person didn't do it. But the problem is that there's a lot of cases where innocent people have been convicted and there is no DNA.
Right.
This case specifically had no DNA at all. And a lot of innocence projects, you know, they don't want to take non-DNA cases, or at least when they approach a case, they immediately look for a DNA angle.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It definitely makes sense, because, you know, you want to have that surefire slam dunk from science. But, like, in this case, there was no DNA, and so basically it was much more difficult. And the Ohio Innocence Project, I give them a ton of credit, because when they realized that this was a case that really sat with Ed Vernon, you know, it sat on this witness actually telling the truth, you know, they didn't shy away from it because it was non-DNA. They went full into it. And I know that a lot of Innocence Projects probably would have shied away.
Wouldn't have taken it, yeah. But what's one of the most incredible things is these three guys got convicted because of this 12-year-old kid. And then these three guys had their convictions overturned because of this now 40-plus-year-old man, right? It largely hinged on his willingness to come forward and say, I made that stuff up. Here's what the police did to me, right?
Absolutely. And it took a lot. You know, my original reporting, I think, kind of exposed Edward Vernon, and it showed very clearly that he had lied on the witness stand. His pastor, who I write about, had read my story after it came out in 2011, and he pushed really hard, nudged Ed in the right direction of coming forward and telling the actual truth. The Ohio Innocence Project were, you know, calling, asking for, you know, to meet with him, because they knew that there was more, that he had more to tell.
And he resisted all of that initially. I'm not surprised.
No. I mean, this was the lie that basically was at the center of his entire life. Mm-hmm. You know, and to come forward and actually admit that was an incredibly difficult thing for him, especially if you then tangle up his addiction issues. You know, he literally told me, with the clarity, I think, of someone who's in recovery, that the fear and the guilt is what drove him to use. He would talk to me about how, you know, he would sit at home at night and after his day of work and start thinking about the case, and then just reach for his crack pipe and use to cloud himself over. So it was very difficult. And I know his issues of sobriety were one of the central reasons why he wouldn't come forward. Because mm-hmm. he was very worried that this would trigger him down that path mm-hmm. that he had finally steered himself away from. And it was really important to me, because when I learned that was what his thinking was, I thought it made much more sense. Now, I don't think it's the right moral position to take mm-hmm. for all those years, but I understand where he's coming from.
Right.
And so I really wanted that to come alive on the page. And then finally, with the right pressure applied by me and other people, he did come forward and say, here's the truth. Here's what happened.
Incredibly brave. Jeannie, we were talking before the show. If I were one of these three guys who'd been for all these years and I saw him in person, I would leap across the banister. And
the rage.
Just the rage, but they didn't have it.
Oh, no. I mean, talking to these three guys, you can't, as they explained to me, you can't have that rage for years and decades.
Yeah.
You just
can't survive in jail.
Yeah, you can't let that become the defining mm-hmm. kind of characteristic of mm-hmm. your life, you know, to be angry and hateful. So what I think is so remarkable about each of these three gentlemen is that they've been able to not let this define their life.
You know, that's remarkable.
Very specific ways. You know, Kwame Ajamu, whose name was Ronnie Bridgman when he was arrested at 17 for this case and convicted, you know, when he was in jail, he told me about how he at one point realized, I'm just going to live the best life I can live. You know, I'm going to just take all the classes I can take. I'm going to learn the things I can take. I'm going to become a great cook. I'm just going to try, you know, I'm stuck here. So I'm going to make my life as good as it can be being in prison. And that means educating myself. He converted to Islam. He became very, very, very dedicated to his faith. So he just wouldn't let the fact that he was in prison define who he was.
Really remarkable people. And listening to, I know a lot of, you know, these interviews, you did so many interviews with them at so many different stages of their life. But listening to their interviews, they're very passionate. They're very articulate about coming to this place of reconcile, whatever, in their lives, which is really remarkable.
Well, you know, what Kwame once told me when we first started to get to know each other, and we became very, very close in 2011 when I was writing the first, or doing the first reporting on this.
For the scene.
For the Cleveland scene. Uh-huh. Is that he had told me, you know, I wasn't a criminal. And I was in jail with all these criminals, and like, but that wasn't who I was. You know, I didn't think that way. I didn't think about how you can always take advantage of someone or pull one over on somebody,
right,
or
be
cut
a snitch.
Angles or be a snitch. You know, he's like, I just, and he would tell me that when he was first in prison, he would always get excited for Christmas. And everyone would be like, why are you excited for Christmas? Like, we're in jail. And he's like, well, I'm an 18-year-old kid. Like, I like Christmas. But everybody else, you know, but like, so his wiring, his hard wiring was so different from everyone else he was around to that he felt so isolated and at odds.
Yeah.
Now, when you took this story on, you were a rookie reporter.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you had not done a lot of courthouse reporting, a lot of the kind of investigation that is required. I mean, it seemed to me from reading this book that you really got a master's degree in journalism just from going through the process of digging through things, of finding transcripts, of...
Should put that on the resume, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Just say master's degree.
Yeah.
The city of Cleveland.
No, it's absolutely true because I was so green. You know, I was 24 or 25 when I first met Kwame. And I'd done some reporting, but really it was just, I didn't really have like a plan of attack. I just went where every kind of hunch took me.
Talk about Michael Roberts. One of your mentors.
Yeah, I love that guy. So Michael Roberts was this famous, like, old school Cleveland journalist.
Every mid-America town has one.
Yeah, for sure. And they're like,
and
they're
the Washington Post has some good ones, yes, as well, as Cal and I have discussed.
Very true, yeah. They're cut from the same, like, cloth, really.
Yeah.
But so Roberts was this guy. He'd been the he'd been the editor of Cleveland Magazine in the 70s and 80s. He was just, he'd been embedded in Vietnam as a reporter. He'd been in, he'd covered the Nixon White House. He was just like one of these legendary guys. And I got to know him in Cleveland, and we would meet at bars in the middle of the day. He'd be like, oh, it's 3 p.m. You know, I'm at the bar. You want to come, like, have,
somewhere.
Yeah, you want to come have a drink. And he just, the way he saw the town, it was this like big Shakespearean stage of like power players and people who were involved. And he made me think about stories about cities that you're covering in a very different way, because he would always say, like, well, what does it say about the town? You know, you're covering a wrongful conviction case on this corner store murder from 1975, but what does that say bigger picture about the town?
Mm-hmm.
I remember you're talking about Mary Ann Kevin's book, the Ariel Castro situation.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking with Roberts about that, and he would say, you know, what's it say about the town that this horrific, like the worst possible situation can be happening in this house.
Right in this neighborhood.
Right in this neighborhood that's a fairly well-known neighborhood and no one knew about. You know, what does that say about the state of the city? And it really, I thought that was like, that simple question was a really beautiful way of understanding reporting and what reporting is supposed to do on a bigger picture.
So to oversimplify like Brian Williams did, three guys, longest wrongful incarceration ever, on the testimony of a 12-year-old kid who was lying. What does it say about Cleveland?
Well, I saw that this particular wrongful conviction story was really about how American institutions had changed after the Civil Rights Movement, how our legal system had gotten less just, how it had gotten less fair to people of color, how it really had become this antagonistic system between police and our communities of color. I thought that was perfectly encapsulated in what happened to these three men.
Yeah, it was remarkable. Okay, so Ed Norton, Kwame says Ed Norton's going to play you in the movie.
Well, I heard your guys' whole conversation.
Yeah.
I was like, I know a book that could be a movie.
I love Ed Norton.
Is going to play Kwame, yeah. Which is
well,
perfect.
Well, there's a big fight about who Denzel will
play.
Oh,
among the three?
But, yeah.
They all want Denzel to play
them? Of course
them?
They do, yeah. Who doesn't?
They should want Michael B. Jordan. He's the one everybody wants.
I know,
yeah. Okay, from the sublime to ridiculous. Ugh, I say this all the time, but people, I said this last week about Jane Levy. If you don't like baseball, you still would love that book she did on Babe Ruth, because it was
absolutely
about Baltimore, it
That's
was about
right.
society, smart ball. You may or may not be interested in what happened to these three guys, but it really is, it just drove home for me what happened with our criminal justice system in the wake of civil rights, what happened in the wake of subprime housing disasters. It's really remarkable. So thank you for doing it.
Thank you
for being with us.
Yeah.
Stay with us because we might rope you into our last segment, which
yeah,
is,
absolutely.
Again, sublime to ridiculous. April Fool's cons. Nice. Nice.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we come right back with Chatter on Books. Well, it sounds tropical, but we're not on the deserted island right now.
But we're going to keep that music for a long time.
Oh, damn straight we are.
Because it's free.
It is. And it makes me feel like I want to have a Banks beer or, you know, Corona or something.
Where did Banks beer come from? All of a sudden I see it advertised and go, how can I not know about this?
I think it's Barbados.
Okay, but all of a sudden they're marketing big time.
Are they?
Yeah.
Have you tried a Banks beer?
I have not.
You
Why
should.
Do you look at me?
Because you're my
beer
guy.
You know everything, yeah. man.
Well, thank you.
You drink beer.
That's the smartest guy I know.
You like beer. Like
I like beer then. Yeah. I like beer now. I'm going to crush
you?
A can of water.
So instead of the deserted island recommendations, we're going to do in honor of April Fool's Day, books about great cons. And I'll go first because mine's the easiest because I'm copping out.
I was going to go first because I'm copping out.
Okay, go ahead. Yours is probably a better cop out.
No, mine is a total cop out because I've never read a lot of books. I don't think I've read any books about con jobs or anything like
You're,
that.
Or all about noble people in World War II.
I read a lot of historical fiction and basically history. But I did read Michael Crichton's book, The Great Train
yeah,
Robbery.
That's a good one.
And it's just this fabulous tale of Victorian era robbery in the 1850s. And it takes forever to plan this job, and there's four keys you got to get. So he there's a lot of planning and scheming that's going on. And it's just fantastic. So Edward Pierce is the lead character in it, and it's a great read. And of course, it was also made in a movie. We talked about that earlier.
Yeah.
Sean Connery, Donald Sutherland, and I believe Jane Seymour. It's a pretty good cast.
Oh,
yeah, it's a
nice,
pretty good cast.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Michael Crichton is one of my favorite authors.
Yeah.
Writes about a bunch of different stuff, and it's imminently readable, whatever you're reading about.
And a lot of research behind his.
Yes. Tons. Yes, yes, okay. yes, yes.
All right, I was going to go back to my tried and true Bad Blood by John Carreyrou, who I'm trying to get on this show, because it's just an amazing story.
I love that
Elizabeth
book.
Holmes, one of the greatest cons of the 21st century, and the number of people she conned, I won't name names,
oh my
but
God.
It was a Henry Kissinger, George Schultz, the list
no
goes on.
No fool like an old fool.
Yeah, exactly.
I am reading about her. That is, woo!
Didn't blink. That's all you need to know. She never blinked.
No.
And changed the tone of her voice to speak very lowly.
Exactly. Okay, that was going to be mine, but instead, and I didn't know about this. This is like I didn't know about that guy in Chicago who caught the ball, so they lost that game.
Bartman?
That. I didn't know about Bartman.
That game.
I didn't know. It was a very busy time in my life. But this thing that George Plimpton did back in the 70s, which was in Sports Illustrated, about the baseball player Sid Finch.
Sid Finch. Yeah, yeah.
That
it was one of the greatest April
Fool's
jokes of all time.
Story. Don't read a book today, tonight, or this week. Go read that. George Plimpton, Sports Illustrated. It is remarkable. And I read it, and then I read it again. And I thought the work he put into this April Fool's joke was spectacular.
Right. You bought it hook, line, and sinker. Because
totally.
It was like, because you had quotes from ball players. This is back before that thing called the internet.
Yeah.
It was like, oh yeah, the guy throws like 120 miles an hour. And you're like, oh my God, please Red Sox sign him.
But the way, it wasn't even the big stuff like that. It was the little things, like the way he described the tarp. Where they brought him in, and the people talking about the Dalai Lama and all this craziness. It was great.
Yeah, Sid Finch.
It was brilliant. Fabulous.
That is brilliant.
Michael?
So I am going back to a book I have not read since my sophomore year at Penn. And this was in a course, The Rise of the Novel. And I was thinking back when I read your homework about Moll Flanders, the Daniel Defoe novel.
Oh, yeah.
So this is early 18th century, and we really have uncharted landscape when it comes to what the novel is. And so most of these early novels still have something along, you know, true account or an autobiography. And we have that with Moll Flanders, where it's supposed to be this confessional.
Yeah.
And everything is going to be tied to sort of absolution towards this religious experience, because we still don't know the journey of where a novel is supposed to go. Henry Fielding's Tom Jones is still a couple of decades away, I believe, if I'm getting my timeline right. But we have this story, this internal look. We're now getting the inside thoughts of characters. And more than that, we're beginning to care what these characters think about and the way they're responding with the world around. And so I went back and I looked at a couple of quotes. But if I remember, this con woman is born of a prisoner of Newgate Prison, and she gets out because she pleads leniency for her pregnancy. And she gets sent to the New World, and she shows actual talent. But because she lives in this world where her value is tied to her ability to marry and sort of what prospects she brings, she goes through all these relationships. She's been used and abused by various men. She has kids along the way. And every time she moves to a new place, she has to create this new character. But it becomes a little bit more complicated because she's not all good. So I have two quotes here. The first is, I was entirely without friends, for I found it was absolutely necessary not to revive former acquaintances. And as you think about that con, the need not to revive, so not to continue these past threads of your life. But moving beyond, she's not all good. By the time we get to the end, you see signs that she wants to repent, that she wants to sort of you know, move to this higher plane. But it's maybe that's just because she's been winning at the hand that she's been dealt. So I Googled a couple of quotes just to see if it brought me back, because I always love to come back to the writing and to the rhythm of these sentences. Poverty brought me into the mire, so avarice kept me in till there was no going back.
Wow.
And it really complicates this character.
I think that could be my bumper sticker on my car. I'm not sure, but I'm thinking. Yeah.
Let's crank those out.
That's awesome. Thank you, Professor Kornheiser.
By the way, before we get to Jeannie and Kyle, it was Leslie Ann Down, not Jane Seymour, in the movie.
Oh, there we go.
And Banks Beer
could be
is,
sisters.
Yes, could be. Yes. Could be. And Banks Beer is, in fact, from Barbados.
There you go.
Just
okay. I'll be drinking it soon.
Okay, so here is a book I really love. Master Thieves, the Boston gangsters who pulled off the world's greatest art heist. It is about the art theft of the Isabella Gardner Museum in Boston, which took place, how smart is this? These guys robbed this museum in the early morning of March 18th, 1990.
Oh, perfect.
So
day after St. Patty's
Boston
Day.
Is yes. celebrating. No, they're still celebrating.
The only other choice is Patriots
St. Patrick's Day. They're in the streets. None of the policemen are looking out for an art heist at that point. These thieves go in. Oh, and by the way, this book is written by a Boston Globe reporter, Stephen Kirchin. Hmm. Does that name sound familiar?
Yes.
He's a cousin of our friend, Avocado Tim Man, Tim Kirchin.
Yes, and mentioned prominently in the movie, what was the movie?
Spotlight.
Yes, Spotlight,
yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And Stephen Kirchin was part of the team that did the Spotlight series.
Yes.
So they go in, posing as policemen. They steal 13 works worth an estimated $500 million. They don't take everything. They don't even take the most valuable works.
Clever.
But they take a Vermeer. Vermeer only is known to have painted 34 paintings. So they take one of the Vermeer, but they leave behind some more expensive ones. They take them out of the frames. They leave the frames and take the paintings. And since 1990, people have been trying to figure out who the heck these...
Great.
I mean, there's a whole mob scene in Boston that's connected to this. It kind of goes up and down the East Coast. Were these works taken to Philadelphia? Were these works buried outside a shed someplace? Never been found.
That's fabulous.
It is a great book. And there is a podcast about the book.
Of course there is.
And about the theft called Last Scene, and I highly recommend that
fabulous
as well.
One. Oh, no, that should be a movie, too.
That should be a
movie. Art thefts are always good movies.
Oh,
great visuals.
Yes.
Great visuals.
Yes.
Okay. We put you on the spot. We didn't ask you to get ready for this, but do you have any, Kyle?
Yeah. I forgot to rep a Washington Post alum, the Steve Call book about Enron's collapse.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very good.
I forgot the name of it, but it's really good.
Yeah, that was a very good one.
And then I guess if I could... A magazine article. Michael Lewis wrote this great magazine article about the 15-year-old kid who scammed a bunch of stocks and got arrested by the SEC.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's great. It was shared around. I think because of...
In my defense, it was a joke that got carried away. I cooperated with all the authorities.
You and Reginald. Yeah. I am beginning to, I don't use the word hate much, but the more I've now read the book about Elizabeth Holmes, I've listened to the podcast, I watched the HBO special, I know more about Elizabeth Holmes than she knows about herself. Wow.
She just got engaged.
Yeah, just got engaged. Right? Yeah.
But God when bless is that she poor coming person. To trial? When is the axe going to fall down
I'm not
on
sure,
her?
But God bless, is it the Daily Mail? Is that the one that's so... They're rivaling TMZ.
Yes.
They got some great photos of Elizabeth Holmes trying to schlep her own suitcase into the back of a taxi in New York. It's like, yeah, how the mighty have fallen. Makes me so happy. Okay, we're done.
Yes, that was outstanding.
Kyle Swenson, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Good Kids, Bad City.
Great work.
People should read it.
Yeah, just fantastic.
Absolutely read it.
What do we got coming up next week?
What we have coming up next week, staying in the neighborhood, Alan Topol, who is a super lawyer by day and writes these books of international intrigue, geopolitical thrillers, he calls them, by night. And evidently, he actually mentioned C.W. Calvert-Woodley, our sponsor, God bless them, in some of his books.
So love that.
We might have to get Michael Sands in.
Crossover.
Yes. Yeah, lots and lots of crossover. But for those of you aspiring non-published authors,
yes, give that information.
Go to chatteronbooks.com, click on the Battle of the Books, and you too can come in and compete in the voice crossed with the Nobel Prize in Literature for fabulous prizes at Chatter.
I love it.
Thanks,
guys. Yes, thanks, everyone.
Thanks
Thank you, Kyle.
Thank
we'll see you guys next week.